listening to the Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an associate editor at the Diplomat, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Catherine Putz, our special projects editor and resident Central Asia hand. Thanks for joining me, Katie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm particularly glad to have you on, given that the topic of the day is Afghanistan, specifically Mullah Mansoor, or shall I say the late Mullah Mansoor. Mansoor was the leader of the Afghan Taliban, who was killed Saturday morning in a U.S. precision drone strike near the Pakistani town of Akhmadwal in Balochistan, with another unidentified man. So today, the day we're recording the podcast is Monday, May 23rd, 2016, and earlier this morning, U.S. President Barack Obama confirmed that the United States is sure that they'd killed Mullah Mansoor. So obviously, this is a bit of a turning point in the ongoing peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, to say the least, but also more generally in the security, in terms of the broader security situation in the region. So Katie, I've had a lot of thoughts about this. I penned a piece for The Diplomat that was mostly speculative, since there's a lot we don't know here, outlining a few questions. And I'm hoping that we can, you know, talk over some of these things today, since I know you watch Afghanistan and Central Asia quite closely. So just very quickly for readers, I'll provide a little bit of context. What's very puzzling to me is that we essentially had no immediate reason to believe that the United States would be looking to neutralize Mansoor, to use the euphemistic term that the Department of Defense uses. Specifically because peace talks haven't been going great, but there was no real sign that Mansoor himself needed to be taken out, or that he was, or the Afghans had indicated that they'd like to essentially remove him from the picture, potentially throwing the Taliban into another leadership struggle like they endured last year after it became apparent that Mullah Muhammad Omar, the group's longtime leader, who was a bit of a recluse, had actually died in 2013. So there was a two-year period when Omar was actually dead, and Mansoor, who used to be Omar's right-hand man, had essentially been pulling the Taliban strings from behind the curtain, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, except for a highly violent militant group in Afghanistan. So Katie, you know, that's essentially a quick rundown of the context. I should add that more recently, the Afghan government, President Ashraf Ghani in particular, made quite an about-face on peace talks with the Taliban after the deadly Kabul bombing in mid-April that killed 67 people, I believe, and injured in excess of 300. And that attack was masterminded by, allegedly, the Haqqani network. And we'll talk a bit more about that when we get into who might step into Mansoor's shoes. But anyways, Katie, before I start rambling too much about this, since I do have a lot of thoughts floating around my head, I thought I'd turn around to you. And what essentially has been on your mind about this? I mean, what do you want to know more about?
So I obviously have an awful lot of questions about this. For a bit of background, I was occupied in the weekend working on the next issue of our magazine, which will come out at the end of the month. And then there were protests in Kazakhstan and a referendum in Tajikistan. So I am glad that you were on the Afghanistan beat this weekend to watch this as it developed. And I think the article that you wrote, the more speculative one, had a lot of good questions in it. And I think with every sort of day after this, we'll have more questions. And I think the place to start, however, is kind of what, you know, who knew what when. If we look back to the Abbottabad strike to take out Osama bin Laden, that certainly, you used the phrase stirred up the hornet's nest or kicked the hornet's nest, in terms of a relationship between the United States and Pakistan. I think many in Pakistan were very upset that the U.S. had come onto its territory and it's a violation of sovereignty. And I think that same feeling is going to apply to this as well, especially given the location. You're getting a little bit closer to where the Taliban has had its leadership for the last several years. And so while Pakistan says that it, you know, is not protecting the Taliban, the presence of the Taliban's leadership on its soil has always kind of given the lie to that. So what are your thoughts in terms of how this will impact not only the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, but as you pointed out, the deterioration of the relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I think you raised so many interesting points, Katie. I'll start with the location, which I think is particularly interesting in this case. So the United States has been carrying out a lot of drone strikes in Pakistan, as people well know. It's been widely covered in the mainstream press. The United States receives a lot of criticism for the practice, but most of these strikes, in fact, all of these strikes to date, have focused on a Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and the federally administered tribal areas, which includes North Waziristan. This strike took place in Balochistan, and as you correctly said, Katie, Balochistan, the provincial capital, Quetta, has been home to the Quetta Shura, which is the Taliban's essential leadership council. Mansour, unlike Mullah Omar, who was a recluse and nobody had really seen him or had a photograph of him for well over a decade, Mansour essentially lived openly. He had a few aliases. We recently found out that he carried a Pakistani passport, but essentially he carried his activities out openly. Balochistan is interesting because it's highly securitized. There's an internal insurgency which has the Pakistani military and intelligence services highly paranoid. They widely expect that India has some sort of role in fomenting insurgency there. So it's highly securitized, and particularly in recent months and in recent years, Balochistan has seen extra securitization due to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which has its southern terminus there at the port of Gwadar. Putting all that context aside, this strike, unlike the one in 2011 that was a CIA-led operation executed by Navy SEALs to take out Osama bin Laden without the knowledge of Pakistan's military or intelligence services, this strike was carried out by Special Operations Forces. And that means that it had the oversight of the Department of Defense and not the CIA. And that's why we actually found out about it immediately. In the case of a lot of these CIA strikes, you won't read public media reports in many cases for months until, a source will intentionally leak it to a reporter to get the news out there. But, the United States has received a lot of criticism. And, both these factors, the fact that it took place in Balochistan and the fact that it was a special operations drone strike, lead me to actually suspect that Pakistan, or elements of the Pakistani establishment, specifically the Inter-Services Intelligence, may have collaborated with the United States. And I know that's a bit of an unusual position for the ISI, since in 2011, the immediate reaction was that here we have Osama bin Laden, the most wanted man in the world, found a few miles from essentially the Pakistani military's equivalent of West Point. How could the Pakistani intelligence services not have known? They were hosting the United States' biggest enemy. Obviously, this is a duplicitous ally. Now, the relationship between Pakistan and the United States hasn't been great in recent weeks as well. We had the big issue of the F-16 sale that DoD approved, but then Congress essentially scuttled amid concerns that the Pakistani military wasn't adequately targeting the Haqqani group. I know I'm rambling a lot, but all of these factors, I think, do play into this strike and kind of decoding the mystery. I will add, Katie, before turning it back to you, that another reason that I suspect that the ISI may have served Mansour up, and we can talk about the reasons why later, is that I don't really think that the United States has the sort of human intelligence capabilities inside Balochistan that would be necessary to acquire the intelligence necessary to carry out a strike. I mean, you can imagine if, DoD went ahead and carried out a drone strike on non-watertight intelligence, and they ended up killing either innocents or other Taliban combatants, but not Mansour himself. I mean, that would have just been a catastrophe on a whole nother level. I mean, the fact that they were confident enough to do their first drone strike in Balochistan and hit a high-value target, specifically Mansour, confirm it in 24 hours, I think says a lot about the quality of the intelligence, and that to me also suggests that the ISI might have been involved.
No, I want to sort of drill down deeper on the intelligence aspect. As you said, you feel that it's reasonable to think that the ISI, if they didn't help, certainly didn't try to hinder, and it seems that they knew that this was going to happen. So Mansour was struck when he was apparently traveling from or back from Iran. And I found that kind of interesting that it I did not know that the Taliban had a presence, a political presence in Iran. What do you think Mansour was doing there? And do you think, I mean, it was kind of odd because he was traveling in a single car apparently, and he usually travels in a convoy. I think you're right. It had to have been watertight intelligence. Do you think Iran had anything to do with part of this? Or is that just sort of a crazy kind of idea?
So, I should preface, and I should have done this at the beginning of the podcast, is that a lot of what we're talking about right now is highly speculative, and it's just the nature of the topic. I mean, you're talking about the ISI, which is highly a clandestine operation that's very difficult to get good, reliable public information on. But the Iran angle is certainly interesting, Katie, and the context there is interesting. Iran and the Taliban are no friends. After last year's leadership spill within the group, you have Mullah Rasul, who essentially broke off. He didn't recognize Mansour's legitimacy to succeed Mullah Omar, and he's been running his own operation in western Afghanistan. And what I've read is that his splinter group, actually have some relatively advanced ties with Iranian security. And that again raises the question of what Mansour was doing in Iran, if indeed he was returning from there. And I think we might have to wait to get some better information about the circumstances of where he was in Iran. I mean, Iran and Pakistan have had a lot of troubles with their Balochistan border. They've exchanged mortar fire as recently as a year and a half ago. Rouhani was recently in Pakistan, and Raheel Sharif, the chief of army staff, essentially accused him of hosting or abetting Indian espionage in Balochistan. So essentially, there's a lot of skepticism there about the Pakistani military do suspect that the Iranians are up to something in Balochistan. The Iranians, for their part, don't really own up to that. They, however, contend that Pakistan isn't sufficiently reining in Sunni militant groups like Jaish-e-Adl. And there was a highly visible incident a few years ago where five Iranian border security forces were abducted and held hostage by these Pakistan-based groups. So there is a lot of bad blood there, and that does raise the very interesting question of what Mansour was doing there. But I think, we'll honestly have to wait to get more info about that.
Yeah, I agree. Something else we should maybe address is certainly who steps into Mansour's shoes. So, as you said before, Mansour was Omar's deputy for years, and so it was a really a natural thing in 2013 when Omar died. Mansour kind of took over and kept up the charade that Omar was still alive. And when that news finally broke, he came out on top of a power struggle. And as you said, Mullah Rasul broke off and has his own splinter group. But who's next? I mean, did Mansour have a deputy who's a clear successor? Will this kind of, I don't know. I'm of two minds about whether the Taliban fracturing is a good thing or a bad thing. Mostly because when you have a unified enemy, it's a lot easier to negotiate with said enemy. If you break something like the Taliban into all of its splinter pieces, that's not necessarily a safer situation, though it might be simpler to mop up in a military fashion.
Absolutely.
But that leaves up and maybe that's why they took out Mansour when they did, is to further kind of crack apart the Taliban.
This is a really interesting question, and I think it's the one that has the most pragmatic impact on how we think about Afghanistan and the peace process going forward. And I'm of a few minds here. Before talking about who might replace Mansour, I think we want to look at why Mansour came to lead the Afghan Taliban. And the reason here, I think, is so Mansour, when he took over, or at least when it became public that he was actually leading the Taliban essentially since 2013 when Omar had died, Mansour was seen as somewhat of a more pragmatic leader. He was more open to peace talks. Obviously, that turned out to be false. I mean, we saw the Taliban carry out the sort of brutality that it did under Mullah Omar himself. Mansour, however, I think might have been a means to an end for the ISI. And the end that I'm referring to here is helping the Haqqani Network, which is a related group, one of the deadliest militant groups actually in the Afghan-Pakistan theater, led by Jalaluddin Haqqani and now his son Sirajuddin Haqqani, goes by Siraj Haqqani for short, essentially to help the Haqqanis set up a foothold within the Taliban structure. In recent months, particularly since late 2015, Siraj Haqqani is the Taliban's on-the-ground commander. He is supposedly responsible for a lot of their military operations. The Afghan government and National Directorate of Security, the Afghan Intelligence Agency, hold that Haqqani masterminded the Kabul strike. So essentially, under Mansour, over the months that Mansour was in power, Siraj Haqqani came to acquire quite a bit of influence within the Taliban. So he's a name that I'd definitely put at the top of my list for the potential next leader of the Taliban. A few other candidates include Mullah Yaqub and Mullah Munan, and they're notable because they're both related by blood to Mullah Omar. But there are some problems with their claims to the throne, so to speak. I've been watching a lot of Game of Thrones, so I'll use that language.
Who hasn't?
Exactly. Yakub is Omar's son, and Manan is Omar's brother. Both of them, however, lost a bit of legitimacy when they chose not to support Mansour initially. There was a bit of a factional struggle, and ultimately, both Yakub and Manan came around to Mansour, but very reluctantly, is what I've heard. So they might not quite have the cachet necessary with the rest of the group to take hold. Another name is Habiatullah Akhundzada, who was actually, when we had some false reports that Mansour had been killed in November and December, his name was immediately floated as a caretaker leader. As of this recording, I'm not sure that the Taliban have announced a caretaker for the group yet, although they have confirmed that Mansour was killed, or at least some spokesmen have confirmed that. The Haqqani angle is really curious for me because it helps explain why the ISI would cooperate with the United States if, you know, my theory about the intel in Balochistan is correct. But the Haqqanis have been very good client for the ISI, essentially. The ISI has been able to control them as a pretty good proxy. They've been able to use them to not only carry out havoc in Afghanistan, but strike at US forces. So it makes good sense that if Mansour was becoming unreliable or if he was becoming inadequately pliable, which we have reason to believe, Sartaj Aziz, the Pakistani foreign affairs advisor to Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, said, speaking in New York a few months ago, he essentially owned up to the fact that some Taliban leaders live in Pakistan, which is actually an acknowledgement that the Pakistani government never makes. And he essentially said that we have some influence over them, but that influence has been waning. So if the Pakistani establishment saw its influence over the Taliban wane with Mansour, perhaps Mansour became disposable, and it made better sense to serve him up on a silver platter to the Americans, get some goodwill there in that relationship. Hopefully, you know, that leads to some F-16s or something down the line, and down the line, Haqqani takes over, and you have a Haqqanified Taliban. And to me, you know, the question that I ask myself there is, what is the United States thinking? Since, in my view, a Haqqanified Taliban is probably way worse than whatever Mansour's Taliban would have come to resemble. And, you know, I think we'll find out what happens down the line. I mean, when this leadership thing becomes resolved, and I think that'll take a few months, perhaps, if there is another long leadership struggle. And you're right, Katie, that we could see further factionalization. Yakub or Manan could choose to lead another faction, and the Haqqanis could, you know, take some of what remains, and we could end up with a highly splintered group again. So there's a lot of questions here.
Yeah, and I think it's a really just sort of coming at it from a historical perspective, it's a really interesting development in the Taliban. Because if you think back to the 90s when the Taliban were sort of sweeping through Afghanistan, the thing that gave them their power over all the various Mujahideen groups was their unity. And so this seems to be fading with every sort of ensuing year. And so that's what I'm looking for. I think it'll get a little bit more confusing to figure out Taliban, well, which Taliban, the Haqqanified Taliban or the Taliban who follow Mullah Rasul or the Taliban that break off here, there, everywhere. So I think it'll be certainly a little bit more confusing, not that it wasn't already confusing.
Yeah. And, you know,
and
sorry, just to add a note, I mean, a lot of this, I think, comes back to the objectives that Pakistan's military intelligence community might have. And I think their goals are fairly modest. They don't necessarily need a unified Taliban. What they need is a Taliban that will keep Afghanistan in a perpetual state of chaos,
Yeah,
essentially
they need
preventing.
something that they can nominally have enough influence that it doesn't blow back on them. But you know, it's playing with fire, I would say.
Exactly. And you know, if Siraj Haqqani does take over the Taliban, it will put the United States in a bind. Obviously, the Haqqani network is designated a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. The Taliban isn't, and that's particularly to allow U.S. representatives. The United States is part of the Quadrilateral Coordination Group on the current peace talks. If the Haqqanis led the Taliban, the United States would have a really hard time sitting down at the table and talking to them. I mean, Haqqani representatives traveled to the Marie peace talks last July. That was right before the whole Omar's death became public and the peace talks fell apart. But the United States sent an observer. That was a big step because you had Haqqani representatives present there. And, you know, that's another huge issue that.
I think you also to sort of go back to a previous issue that you had brought up, the fact that if as we think might be true, the ISI at least participated in terms of intelligence in getting this strike done. If that's true, and the way sort of these things might play out, the clearly Pakistan has different aims for what will happen after this than what the United States has. And so which side's vision of how things will unfold will be interesting. But it strikes me as a case of working together on something but wishing something else will happen afterwards. It's kind of a very interesting the Pakistani-U.S. relationship is a very interesting frenemies kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Katie. And I think that's actually a good note to wrap this conversation up on, and look forward to I guess we'll both look forward to learning more about this. Certainly there's some questions that I think we'll never get answers to, like specifically what role the ISI played in enabling the strike, if it did at all, or if the United States sourced the intelligence and Balochistan all by itself, which in itself would be remarkable.
Yeah,
But
certainly not in any kind of short term. Those are the kind of things that come out 5 decades from now.
yeah, absolutely, and hopefully we're still alive to read about them then,
We'll
if
do a
they
podcast then too.
Exactly. If they still do, if they still release highly redacted PDFs.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll be reading PDFs, so we'll see holograms perhaps in the
Yeah.
future. Anyways, Katie, thanks a lot for joining me for this great conversation today.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. And for listeners, do remember to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss future episodes. And do keep an eye on both our Crossroads Asia and Pulse blogs, where we will cover Central Asia and Afghanistan in more detail. And since Katie's on today, I will plug the upcoming issue of the magazine. We've got a great lead feature coming up from Aidan Foster Carter on North Korea, looking at the Workers' Party Congress, along with a lot of great other content. So definitely do check that out when it comes out. Thanks for listening.